podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology with an MFT evening format. Priority deadline to apply for September classes is July 8th. gsep.pepperdine.edu.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take 2. I'm Martinez, loving this short work week. The weekend is almost upon us. Coming up on today's show, fire and water. We'll look at the new analysis of the state that says the state just isn't doing enough prescribed burns to reduce wildfire risk. And we'll also take a deep dive into SoCal's long and troubled history with water.
We are a place of drought, flood, wildfire, mudslide. And so we have these havocs that we create on our own. So now you add climate change onto that inherent nature of California, we're going to be in a new reality that I'm not sure we're prepared for.
Author Mark Arox talks about his new book, The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California. That's coming up in about 15 minutes. But we start today with politics. Now, in many ways, it feels like we're waiting for something to happen, or actually maybe not. After Robert Mueller gave his statements about the Russia investigation and announced his resignation from his role as special counsel at the Justice Department, a lot of people are now wondering what the next move will be and who is going to make it. Well, that's the question we asked California Congressman Adam Schiff, who chairs the House Intelligence Committee. He says that the special counsel's office may be closed, but there is more to be done.
I really believe Bob Mueller has one more service yet to provide, and that is to answer questions for Congress and the American people. He worked on this investigation for nearly 2 years, and I think the public deserves more of a presentation than the 10 minutes that we got yesterday, as impressive as that is. So there are a whole host of unanswered questions, which I think that he's in a very good position to answer, that don't leap off the dry page. In fact, aren't included in the report. And, you know, from our perspective on the Intelligence Committee, chief among those are what happened to the counterintelligence investigation and what did it learn?
Your colleague, New York Congressman Gerald Nadler, said that Mueller told us a lot of what we need to hear. And I'm wondering, you mentioned you want more than just the 10 minutes we got yesterday, but what did you hear from Robert Mueller yesterday?
I think I really heard two things. First, he chose to begin and end on the same note, and that is the seriousness of the Russian interference in our election and our democracy. He seemed to be saying, as important as the focus is on what Donald Trump did or his campaign did, let's not forget the most fundamental point, and that is the Russians interfered in our affairs. And what's more, I think, implied in that is they may very well do so again, and we need to prepare. And I have to imagine there's some frustration on the Mueller team that that point, that the systemic interference in our election seems to be glossed over by many people. And of course, we've seen the reports now confirmed that the administration at the top levels can't even bring this up with the president because he views it as a threat to his legitimacy. And we're not taking many of the steps we should be taking to protect our elections in 2020.
How much attention is Congress paying to that, and what needs to be done to prevent it from happening next year and the following years after that?
Well, certainly we're paying a great deal of attention to it in Congress, although I have to say some of the most serious legislation that we need has been stymied by the GOP. I think we should be mandating that elections, all the voting equipment, all have a paper trail, and there's still many, many jurisdictions in localities that are swing counties and states that do not have a paper trail, which is just negligence, I think, on its face these days. But the bigger problem is getting the administration at the top levels to focus on this problem, having a whole of government driven by the top approach. That's just not happening. The president should be asking of each and every cabinet member, Secretary of Defense, what are you doing to deter the Russians from further meddling? And Secretary of State, what are your conversations with your Russian counterpart? And are you telling them the kind of sanctions we'll impose if we catch them again? Director of Intelligence, what are you hearing about Russian plans and intentions? Director of Homeland Security, what states are not cooperating in your efforts to assess their vulnerabilities? This is the kind of leadership we need. It's completely absent in the White House, worse than absent. Every time the president talks to Putin and calls this all a hoax, he's basically telling Putin, go ahead and interfere again. As long as you do it on my side, I'm too weak to call you out on it. That's not the kind of leadership that's going to protect us going into 2020.
Talking to California Congressman Adam Schiff. Now, beyond the Mueller report, what answers are you hoping to hear from Mueller should he testify?
Well, a number of things. I think the country would like to know why he didn't pursue an interview with the president more vigorously. Was it really just a question of it taking too long? Were similar decisions made about the attorneys that participated in the review of Michael Cohen's false testimony before it was presented to our committee? Why was that not an issue investigated by the special counsel? Did they view that as taking too long to litigate the attorney-client issues that would be raised by that? Again, the counterintelligence questions. What do we know about this Konstantin Kilimnik, and why were you unable to find out more about the use of polling data? Why was the campaign chairman giving polling data to someone linked to Russian intelligence? There are a great many questions that he should be able to answer.
Congressman, do you think that in his report and in what we heard yesterday, that Robert Mueller laid out a roadmap for President Trump's impeachment?
I think he was very careful about two things. First, he wasn't going to say that in the absence of the OLC opinion, he would have indicted the president. And he also wasn't going to tell Congress what it ought to do specifically with his report. He wasn't going to say, therefore, you should impeach. I think he left it to Congress to determine whether impeachment is warranted, whether to do the investigation as part of an impeachment inquiry or as part of its oversight function. He really left those decisions to Congress. I think he wanted his report to be as factual, objective, nonpartisan as he could, and non-incendiary. He didn't want, I think, the central conclusion about Russian interference to be missed. And so it really does fall on Congress to make those decisions. I didn't hear much in what he said yesterday to guide us one way or another on the impeachment question. My own feeling is I may get there, and the president seems to be pushing me and others in that direction. But I would like to see us do further oversight before we make that critical decision, because I think once we open an impeachment inquiry, it carries a force of its own and inexorably, I think, leads to a vote on the House floor to impeach and then a trial in the Senate. And before we make a decision that consequential, we should make sure that it's the best thing for the country.
Because within your own party, Congressman, it just seems like there are different forces at work and different opinions being said. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has thus far resisted when it comes to calls for impeachment. I know that over 40 House Democrats have called for the impeachment inquiry to start. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez says failure to impeach now is a neglect of due process. So what's your message to Democrats who are kind of stoking this flame?
You know, I would say, look, we can begin an impeachment at any time, and that's a hugely consequential step that ought to be made if we decide this is the right thing for the country, to put the country through this. It's going to be a wrenching experience and one not to be made lightly and not to be made, I think, because people decide in one party or the other that it's politically advantageous to do it or not to do it. So I think it's a really important decision. There are really profound arguments at this point to be made. That if we don't impeach, it sends a message that his conduct is somehow compatible with office. On the other hand, if we do impeach and he is acquitted in the Senate, as is very likely to be the case, then you have an adjudication that this conduct is not impeachable. Those are both, I think, troubling outcomes, and that makes it a very difficult dilemma. So I think we continue to do our oversight, and we may reach the point, depending on the president's further conduct, where it just becomes inevitable and necessary, but I'm not there yet.
What would get you there? Because if the president's conduct is going to be investigated, you're not going to get help from the Department of Justice, definitely not from the White House. The GOP-controlled Senate may not be too helpful either. So, Congressman, what would it take to get you there?
Well, you know, one thing I think that would certainly get me there is if the president simply ignores court orders. That, to me, would be a very real constitutional crisis. If the courts decide, as they have been, that the president has to provide documents, that witnesses do have to appear before the grand jury or ultimately before Congress, and those appeals are unsuccessful, and the president still ignores court orders, seems to me there is no option left but an impeachment proceeding, regardless of its outcome. But there may be other things short of that, frankly, that compel it nonetheless. And I'm keeping an open mind on it, and we'll keep an open mind on it, because it may ultimately be necessary.
That's California Congressman Adam Schiff. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Not a wildfires, or more specifically, a way to prevent them. Prescribed burns are one of the methods firefighters use to clear vegetation that could potentially act as fuel. Most agree it's an effective tool for reducing wildfire risk, but according to a new analysis out this week, California is falling behind in its regimen of controlled burns. Crystal Colden is the author of the report, an associate professor of fire science at the University of Idaho. She's in San Diego right now doing some field work, some fire field work, but she took some time from her lunch break to speak with us. Crystal, welcome to Take Two.
Glad to be here.
And thanks for taking some time from your lunch break, too. I mean, you're doing some fire field work, so you're squeezing us in. So thanks for that, too.
Not a problem. I'm glad to talk about the work.
All right. Now, California is falling behind in the controlled burns as fire managers do. Can you put that into context for us, though, Crystal? How far are we falling behind?
Well, falling behind is a way of describing that there's sort of a fire deficit California has. But what I looked at and what I think is really important for people to understand is that I looked at over 20 years of prescribed fire data across the country. And what I saw in California was that there was actually very little prescribed fire to begin with. And then there's actually been a decline over the last 20 years. And the problem with that in the larger context of wildfire in California is that, of course, we've seen this huge increase in wildfire in California and specifically in wildfire disasters. And since prescribed fire is specifically useful for mitigating those potential wildfire disasters, the fact that we're not using it presents a missed opportunity.
Now, you found that the southeast part of the country is doing more prescribed burns than California in the west. Is that a fair comparison?
Oh, by far. The southeast has a long history of doing prescribed fire. They've been doing this for over eight decades, and they are burning millions of acres a year. In California, it's only tens of thousands of acres. It's just not very much comparative. And that, you know, the southeast is a much bigger area, of course, than California. But as a proportion of the area, it's just still a really small number in California. And that's a problem for the state.
What would you say, though, Crystal, if someone said, well, our topography is a little more challenging, we've got more harder to reach areas?
There's a lot of reasons that California is sort of not doing more prescribed burning and that it's difficult to prescribe burn in the state. Topography and how much the fuels are flammable and sort of ready to burn across a lot of the year and turn into a wildfire, that is a problem. The thing that California has that's really different is a different social attitude towards fire. And Californians and Westerners more broadly are sort of really scared of fire, and they look at fire as a bad thing.
So even we're scared of even a good fire.
That's true. We are scared of even a good fire in the West. And in California, one of the things that the public also fears associated with prescribed fire is the smoke.
Yeah.
And California has some of the strictest air quality regulations in the country, which make it really, really difficult for fire agencies to do prescribed fire because they're always coming up really close to that threshold where air quality agencies will shut them down.
Crystal, so then our hands are a little bit tied then in some ways. I mean, even if we'd wanted to do more prescribed burns, maybe we can't because our air quality isn't great to begin with.
Well, the thing that you have to think about is how can we change and what needs to be changed in terms of policy and in terms of how we can support these things in order to enable more prescribed fire use, right? Because the Southeast didn't used to have all this prescribed fire, and they have changed over time. And there's certain things that they've done that we could look at doing in California. So things like having laws that actually look at prescribed fire as a good thing, as a public good, and make individuals less liable for if a prescribed fire escapes.
The other part, Crystal, is too, we actually have actual fires to deal with as well. So I can imagine that having prescribed burns for a lot of people would be like, well, we already got to deal with this to begin with.
Yeah. And the way that people struggle to look at it and the way that we'll actually start to change things is, you know, the problem for a lot of Californians is that they didn't see a lot of fire for decades, and they still want to think that not having fire at all is an option. But that's not an option. Our option is either wildfire or some sort of mitigation action like prescribed fire. And so if you look at it that way and say option A is prescribed fire and other types of mitigation strategies. And option B is an uncontrolled wildfire where instead of smoke for a few days or instead of, a low risk, I'm just going to have an uncontrolled wildfire that produces potential home loss, major fatalities, all sorts of additional problems. If you're looking at those as the two options, then prescribed fire is the thing that makes the most sense.
All right. So what could change? What could change, Crystal, and how do we get there?
A lot of things need to change. It's not going to happen overnight. And the thing is that people need to be patient and they also need to get involved, right? Because we're not going to be able to use more prescribed fire without the public supporting it and, in fact, asking for it. And that's what we see in the southeastern U.S. is that people actually call fire agencies in parts of the southeast and ask them, when are you going to come to my house? When are you going to burn the back 40 behind my property? Because I see an enormous amount of fuels there, and I want it to get burnt so I don't have to worry about a wildfire. So it's that type of support. It's that type of initiation from the public, getting involved with prescribed fire councils, and that ground-up approach that will really initiate change over time, because that's what initiates policy changes, and that's what initiates legislative changes that also change how these things are funded, right? Because prescribed fire, like anything, takes a lot of money. And so that's the sort of thing that also is required, and people have to support it for that money to be supplied for those sorts of activities.
Crystal Colden is Associate Professor of Fire Science at the University of Idaho. She spoke with us about the decline of prescribed burns here in California. Crystal, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having me.
Moving water from point A to point B has been, for better or worse, something of a point of pride for Californians. The state would not be the worldwide economic giant it is if we hadn't. But bending nature to our will can have some serious drawbacks. Coming up, we'll hear about the California water titans that have controlled the flow of our H2O from Beverly Hills to Nob Hill. That's ahead when Take 2 continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. I think it's a safe, nonpartisan thing to say that California, in economic size, scope, and influence, is without peer in the United States and almost in the whole world. Now, you may have heard this mind-blowing stat before, but it bears repeating. If California were its own nation, it would have the fifth largest economy on Earth. One of the biggest reasons it got this way was residents' stubborn yet uncanny ability to move water from where it rains to where it doesn't. I know, sounds godlike, right? But all this goes even deeper than William Mulholland's infamous "there it is, take it" statement when his Los Angeles aqueduct moved water from 200 miles north to the south from the Owens Valley over a century ago. It's about California's thirst to control one of the planet's most basic substances, water, and then bend it to our will. That's what Mark Arox's new book is all about. It's called The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California. Mark has always had an interesting relationship with water. He grew up in the Central Valley, where he learned at a young age just how important it is.
As a kid growing up, I remember my grandparents, when we sold our last farm along the San Joaquin River, moved to suburbia in Fresno, where I grew up, you would see these irrigation canals slicing across the landscape. In fact, there was one just three houses down from my grandmother. But you never thought as a kid to ask yourself, well, where's that water coming from? Where's it going to whom, and by what right? You know, all I knew is grandma said, do not go near that irrigation canal. If you walk up the embankment and on top, you will fall in, and no one's going to come to save you. They won't even hear you, and they won't come to get your body, because the flow of that irrigation canal is more important to the valley than recovering the body of one silly boy, she said. So she gave me a forever fright of water.
So you know where you stood, right? You are definitely not on the same plane as water in the Central Valley.
No. So as I got older and you're trying to puzzle out your place, I mean, the first question you have to ask yourself is, you know, there was this incredible bending, a bending of resources that invented this place, yeah. this singular place in the world, as you said. And how did that come about? And what were the transitions and the pivots? And then what did it mean on the land today?
All right, so combine those roots with investigative reporter skills and a knack for storytelling, and then you've got your newest book, The Dreamt Land. And I mentioned William Mulholland earlier, Mark, and it's probably the one California water story that most people know something about. But how far back do our water wars really go?
Well, the water wars go back to the gold mine. You know, the mining of gold was really the mining of water first. And so you had all these, you know, 80,000 people in a year come to California, this supercharged beginning after we had taken it from the native. And you see the fights happen right from the get-go. Back then, they measured the water by the miner's inch. And they started claiming those rivers that came out of the Sierra. And they started shunting their flow into these flumes, which were nothing but wooden ditches. And then taking that flow and putting it in a hydraulic hose with a nozzle and creating the hydraulic system that we know today. So it began up there in that hill.
So we've been doing this a long, long time. I mean, you're talking about like the 1840s, 1850s there. Who were some of the first people, Mark, who became the state's first real water power brokers?
So you had these industrialists who made a lot of money off the gold mines. And in the 1880s, the mining of gold started conflicting with the farming because the rivers were silting up. And that silt was destroying the farmlands in the alluvial plains. So California had a choice. Were we going to continue to mine gold, or were we going to start to mine the soil? And so these very industrialists who had made money off the gold rush were living in Knob Hill, fancy Knob Hill in San Francisco, and they started buying hundreds of thousands of acres in the middle of the state and planting wheat. And no one was bigger than Isaac Friedlander, and he ended up becoming the wheat king of America. And he would harvest his wheat, and then he had these clipper ships that would sail that wheat. It was called California Velvet, and it was much prized back in Europe. And he would sell it in Liverpool. And so you see that culture of extraction coming down on the valley floor. And at some point, the mining of wheat ends up stealing so much fertility from the soil that California then has another choice.
And what is that other choice?
That other choice is, what do we grow on this land that has these five rivers that come through it, the most fertile soil anywhere, and these sierras that are a watershed, and then this Mediterranean climate. And out of that, we decide that we're going to grow the specialty crops, fruits, nuts, vegetables that can't be grown anywhere else like they're grown in California. And that becomes the selling of LA through the Washington Navel Orange. That's what Mulholland and his water ended up paving over, because once you had enough water, then you could grow cities. You couldn't do that on the puny flow of the LA River, so you had to go steal a river. Once that river was stolen and suburbia started covering up LA, you saw the citrus culture come up and over the mountain.
So that's when, Mark, people here in California realized, and as you mentioned, they decided to grow stuff, other stuff. They realized that at that point, if that's going to happen, water needs to start moving around the state.
That's right, because what happened is the farmers in the San Joaquin Valley, they ended up basically using up their rivers about 1910. They want to grow more, of course. That's the ethos of this place. And so the turbine pumps get invented. And the turbine pump now allows them to not only take the river's flows, which they were doing through ditches and canals, but now they could go into the groundwater and extract that. And so we see a whole nother level of extraction. But at some point, not even the turbine pump could go deep enough. And so then becomes this cry to do what LA did. We need to steal us a river. And that cry comes out of the counties of Tulare and Kern. And what grows out of that cry is the construction of the Central Valley Project, the biggest hydraulic engineering project the world had ever seen. That was the damming of the Sacramento River, the damming of the San Joaquin River, and the moving of that water from north to middle. And then comes the State Water Project 20 years later in the 1960s. And that adds on to that system, and it's going to move the water from north all the way to south via that aqueduct, that great artificial river that we built. And now we're confronted with a system, as magnificent as it was, that is cracking from all the demands. And what is going to give?
We're talking to Mark Arocz about his new book, The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California. Now, throughout its history, California goes through drought, then flooding, then drought again, and now factoring in climate change, Mark, I'm wondering how much longer can we play God with our water?
It's a very good question. So inherently, we are a place of drought, flood, wildfire, mudslide, and so we have these havocs that we create on our own. So now you add climate change onto that inherent nature of California, and you're going to be creating havocs we've never seen before. And we're getting a taste of that right now. The last drought was a historic drought. But if you look at the tree rings and the redwood forests, you will see that 6 years of drought is not all that extreme. I mean, you could have 10, 20 years of drought. So yes, we don't need climate change to create these swings. And now that we're getting it, we're going to be in a new reality that I'm not sure we're prepared for.
Now, you know, as I was reading the book, in many ways, I was kind of imagining that controlling where water flows can almost extend to owning rain in some ways. Here in California, who's today's big water titan or titans?
Well, I was able to really tell the present day story of these giants. So I'm weaving history. I'm weaving reportage from today. I'm weaving in memoir, my own family story, to tell this story of California's invention in water in a different way. And I was able, through a lot of persistence, to get inside the empire of Wonderful, which is owned by Stuart and Linda Resnick. They live on Sunset Boulevard in Beverly Hills, and they farm more land in California than anyone. And they use more water than anyone. And their farming empire, the kind of headquarters of it in the San Joaquin Valley, is in Lost Hills. There are only 80 or 90 miles that separate, as a crow flies, Beverly Hills to Lost Hills, but they couldn't be two different places. And really, Resnick is like a throwback to Isaac Friedlander and the cattle king Henry Miller, you know, living somewhere else and farming from a distance, the valley, and controlling this extraordinary amount of water and land.
Now, the thing is, Mark, here in California, we're not going to stop growing crops. We're not going to stop making babies. We're not going to stop having wildfires. And we keep saying that we need to build more housing at all different affordability levels. All of that takes a lot of water. Mark, if the state's water supply could speak, you think it could ever say, hey, sorry, there just ain't enough to go around for all this?
Well, I think it spoke in the last drought. In the life of the State Water Project, the population of California has gone from 11 to 40 million. As we're having this conversation, we never start with, well, what is our number? What's our sustainable number? Is it 50 million, 60 million? I mean, it's cracking already, this system, and something is going to give. And do we value having the most extraordinary kind of farming experiment that man has ever done in the middle of the state? Or are we willing to see it paved over like the San Fernando Valley? I mean, this is the question. The problem is we're not asking the question, and it's just going to happen in this kind of small way. Little decisions here and there that become bigger and bigger decisions, and pretty soon you look up and you see that half the best farmland in the world has been paved over with suburbia. Is that what we want? And so hopefully this book will start a conversation.
One last thing. Say in 10 years, the movie version of your book comes out and we're going to speak again. Since you're as close to this as anyone, in 2029, will we be chasing water in California or be chasing dust?
That's a great question. I think we're going to see water make more movement. Farmers are probably going to sell it up and over the mountains so suburbia can grow in LA, and they'll probably sell it to their own developers here in the middle so they could pave it over. I think we'll be chasing both for a while. But climate change is going to have a lot to say about that as well.
Mark Arocz's new book is The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California. Mark, thanks a lot.
Hey, thank you so much. I have great questions, and I love the way you framed the segment, too. Thank you.
All right, I bet most drivers overestimate their skill level behind the wheel. I do not. I'm LA's best driver. I mean, that's an indisputable fact. Can't dispute it. I can make any move needed on the road. I'm also super cautious and super considerate. As I said, best driver in LA. Well, now there's an app that will pit my driving skills against every other driver in the city. Find out all about it when Take Two continues. Stay with us.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth. An online hybrid tailored for working professionals with attendance only twice per term in West LA. Attend an information session to learn more. Classes start September. Apply by June 3rd for a $1,500 scholarship at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez, and the empire has struck back. That empire being Disney, of course. CEO Bob Iger did an interview with Reuters while talking about the new Galaxy's Edge at Disneyland. He was asked about Georgia's new law that heavily restricts access to abortion. Iger said if the new law became official, it's doubtful the company would continue to produce projects there.
Many people who work for us will not want to work there, and we'll have to heed their wishes in that regard.
His voice joins many others in Hollywood who talked about withdrawing business from the state because of the anti-abortion law. Here to give us the latest is Brooke Barnes, who covers Hollywood for The New York Times. Brooks, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Good, good. All right, so after Iger spoke, other big media companies such as NBC Universal, Warner Media followed suit. Remind us of the size of the film industry in Georgia in terms of jobs and the economy.
Yes. So Netflix kind of kicked it off earlier this week. But it's a huge business for Hollywood there. I think about 100,000 jobs and $2.7 billion in revenue. And they go there, of course, because there are big soundstage facilities now, but they get up to 30% tax rebates for doing production there. And that's a pretty big piece of the budget when you're looking at $200 million movies.
So it could be potentially a big hit if Hollywood pulls out. And not the first time, actually, that Hollywood has threatened to pull out from the state. Many studios did it back in 2016 when the state passed a law that would have discriminated against LGBT people. Georgia's then governor eventually vetoed it because of the pressure. But Brooks, what are the ways these two events are similar and then maybe different?
The 2016 threatened boycott, Disney was one of those companies, was different in one big way. They saw it more in a black and white discriminatory way. And, you know, it wasn't a hard call to say, you know, this is discrimination and we're not going to film there. This since then, 3 years, that business has only grown. They're more financially intertwined in Georgia. But this issue is abortion is more complex politically, socially, moral issues, religious. And even though Hollywood has this, you know, very deserved image as a liberal stronghold and the titans of these companies are big Democratic donors. Mm-hmm. Disney has 200,000 employees. They're people on both sides of the abortion issue inside that company. You know, they have a huge profit center in Florida. And so there are lots of things that they are sort of weighing. And basically what we're seeing so far is no one saying that we're going to pull out. If you even look at the Iger's statement, he said it would be very difficult. He didn't say it would be impossible. The NBCU statement was
going to hedge in their bet a little bit.
Strongly impact. Yeah, and so the law doesn't take effect in, you know, courts let it stand until January, and that's really when we're going to see studios evaluating how they move forward.
Talking to Brooks Barnes, who covers Hollywood for the New York Times. Now, although this most recent abortion law passed, media companies are waiting to see how it holds up in court. But if these studios do decide to pull out, what would that take logistically?
Well, it would idle enormous soundstage facilities that are there around Atlanta. It would, at the moment, you know, production is set. And so we've seen people saying, we're going to continue and we'll give donations to the ACLU. Mm-hmm. A couple of people have said we're not going there, but no one who has, that I know of, who is a big production currently there saying we're moving. Down the road, you could have like a Marvel, for example, that's made a lot of movies there, Black Panther. They could say, we're not going there. At the moment, they have nothing scheduled, but it'll be interesting to see where their next big movie goes. Marvel does have television shows about to take place there.
Yeah.
You know, these are hundreds of people who all have livelihoods to look at. And so it's not just the company and their own bottom lines.
And then on that, though, in terms of where they might go, because I'm wondering, I mean, it may be schadenfreude a little bit, but could it actually be good mm-hmm. for the industry in Los Angeles?
It could be. The sound stages in Los Angeles are pretty booked, even with the greater incentives in Georgia with television production. It probably would move a lot to London as a big financial incentive in other spots. But it absolutely could benefit California, which has been more receptive to this kind of help for Hollywood.
Now, Brooks,
to the degree it needs it.
Let's make a turn in the time we have left, a Millennium Falcon style turn to Galaxy's Edge, which is where Bob yes. Iger was doing that Reuters interview. Our listeners are really excited about it. I mean, there's like an energy in this building with the people that work here even. You got a tour. What are the three, say, big takeaways from your day at the park?
Big takeaways. One is that, you know, my experience on these Disney openings is that they always say the same thing. It's more immersive than we've ever had, you know, the layers of detail. And this time, I have to say, I was actually impressed.
Ooh,
they really did.
A hardened journalist impressed.
It's something that I haven't seen Disney do before in terms of the changes in role play. It's supposed to be much more toward, you know, the modern consumers, I guess, kids who want something more participatory.
Yeah.
Another takeaway would be don't rush out.
Don't rush out.
Crowds are going to be crazy. The biggest ride is not open yet until the end of the summer or later this year. They haven't said, so you might as well just, you know, take it easy for a while.
But the thing is, okay, so you were impressed, right? Yeah. But despite all this buzz, I mean, you would have liked Disneyland to remain the happiest place on earth without Tatooine, right?
Well, yes. I'm one of those, you know, purists, I guess, who wants Disneyland to remain trapped in amber, as I remember it as a 9-year-old first going there. I know that's ridiculous, but, you know, I've gotten a lot of emails from residents, annual pass holders in Southern California today about, you know, like, I can barely go by that Tarzan treehouse without taking a Xanax. I know exactly what you mean.
Well, Brooks, move aside, Brooks Barnes. Life and progress is passing you by. Brooks Barnes is a Hollywood reporter for the New York Times. Brooks, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Bye.
Now, if you crash the Millennium Falcon, there's not a lot I can offer you, but there is a new initiative in L.A. that aims to make you a better and safer driver of cars. L.A. Mayor Eric Garcetti announced the new program to improve street safety yesterday, and it probably isn't what you think. It's called L.A.'s Safest Driver, and it's a contest that rewards Angelenos who drive as safely as possible. The idea is to kind of gamify it a bit. And winners could receive as much as $20,000 for participating. Now, here's the statement from Mayor Eric Garcetti about it. Quote, "If we are going to eliminate traffic fatalities and serious accidents on our streets, we need to put an end to the epidemic of distracted driving. Some friendly competition is a great way to drive home the importance of keeping our minds and eyes on the road," end quote. Interested drivers can download the LA's Safest Driver app. Then, using telematics, which is essentially how your car communicates with your phone, the app will grade them on 5 behaviors: speed, acceleration, braking, cornering, and distraction. All my specialties, by the way. Drivers can see how they're doing by checking out the app's scoreboard, which then compares them to other drivers and tells them where they did poorly. Now, just don't check the app while you're driving because, number one, it's dangerous, and number two, the app will know and then grade you accordingly. San Antonio, Boston, and Seattle have all done similar safe driving contests. Now, in San Antonio, the contest resulted in a 15% reduction in distracted driving and a 46% reduction in speeding among the 14,000 people who downloaded that app. Now, for its part, LA has set a goal of eliminating all traffic deaths by 2025 as a part of Vision Zero. All right, it's coming down to the wire at the Scripps National Spelling Bee. A pair of local spelling whiz kids are still alive. One is from the IE, the other Orange County. Find out why. If either one is the last kid standing and spelling, it will make history. That's coming up when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. This past Sunday was the 8th annual LA Zine Fest, where art makers and their fans gathered to see the works of over 200 independent vendors. What's a zine, you may ask?
A zine is a little book.
A little booklet.
A fun mini magazine.
Easy to make and reproduce.
A snatch of the propaganda machine in which we are making our own propaganda. We are documenting our own stories and experiences, our own histories.
A zine can be anything you want it to be.
And by anything, that means anything.
I make some queer Peanuts fan fiction.
Bi-monthly punk fanzine.
Radical queer anti-assimilationist counterculture.
KPCC's Ari Saperstein spent a weekend immersed in LA zine scene to learn what makes it a special and brings us this report.
Cynthia Navarro and Amory Sanford define a zine not by what it is, but by what it isn't.
It's not Vogue.
Not Vogue. And not the New York Times.
Not the New York Times.
Navarro runs Tiny Splendor, a small press in Silver Lake where artists like Sanford can print their zines on the cheap.
Switch the drums and print settings. Hold down this button and you'll see the tree.
It's a good system.
Like most zine makers, Navarro assembles zines manually, laying out prints, ordering and folding them, then binding them in a number of ways, including stapling, gluing, and sewing them by hand.
There's a lot of labor, but it's all of, like, love.
Zines aren't about profit. They're about passion, Navarro says.
There's no money in zines. They're not rich off of zines. I think zines should be affordable.
While small presses like Tiny Splendor print and assemble a more polished product for a small fee, most zine makers do the work themselves, like Ellie Dallas. She makes her zines from black and white photocopies folded in half. Here she is at Book Show in Highland Park, reading an excerpt from her latest zine about being a teacher.
April 22nd, student teaching is a special kind of stress. These past 4 to 5 months, I've received way more feedback on my body, what I'm wearing, my age, my size, than anything involving teaching or classroom management.
If it sounds like a journal, that's because it is.
Zines are, like, helpful for me to process something as I'm going through it. So, yeah, anyone else who maybe was student teaching or will be in the future could read that and find some humor or maybe some hopeful words in there.
That's the thing about zines. They're intimate. And when they're shared, they often lead to a personal connection.
I mean, if you make zines and someone else makes zines, you're probably going to be friends.
Sure enough, the LA Zine Fest seems less like your typical convention and a lot more like a family reunion.
Hi! Oh my god!
Oh, good to see you!
Oh, I gotta hug this person. BRB.
Zine makers Chris Saldana and Aristotle Acevedo say that friendship is the main draw.
We definitely made friends here for sure. And that's the cool part about coming to LA Zine Fest is you get to hang out with all of them because some of them live far away.
There's also always a good mix of new people there.
New
like,
people,
oh
yeah.
Man, how have I not known about this amazing work?
It could be that some of the new people are really new.
Hi, I'm Casper. I'm 12.
My name is Colette. I'm 12 years old.
I can't see many other kids around here.
There aren't actually a lot of kids. We were the youngest ones last year, and I think we are this year. I made one last year called Why You Should Hate Seafood, and I gave some reasons on why. It sold out.
Colette and Casper might be older than the LA Zine Fest, which started in 2012, but zines themselves date back to the 1960s and the various counterculture movements of the time.
The very first zines that I've seen that are in the One Archives were queer,
and the people that were writing them were being targeted by the FBI because it was seen as propaganda.
That's Edzi. She helps make the LA queer resistance zine, which reflects those political, subversive roots. And that undercurrent runs throughout ZineFest.
Snatch Power is a Black, queer, post-apocalyptic, Afrofuturistic art collective.
Sondria Wrights is a contributor to the Snatch Power zine. It's a mix of essays, art, and photos.
Yes, there's just a lot of naked, brown, and Black people being queer and free and sexy. Why is everything so good?
There didn't used to be a whole lot of Black people here when I first started coming to ZineFest. And being able to represent myself, I think, is important. If you don't see yourself at ZineFest, get a table. Like, you are welcome here.
Another place that zine makers are welcome is the LA Public Library, which has a booth at the fest promoting its zine library. It started 2 years ago at the Baldwin Hills branch, and now 7 locations have collections. Zine library founder Ziba Zadar thinks that when people see their zines in the library, it sends a clear and powerful message.
That they matter. It's like, oh, their voice matters.
Zines?
A zine can be anything you want it to be.
Says Eileen Chavez, who makes illustrated zines about mental health.
A lot of the zines are like might be cut a little bit off, or like there's little like misprints or smudges, but I feel like that's also a part of it, you know? It's kind of imperfect, messy, working through emotions and kind of pushing against those like normative expectations of like a very polished, perfect product.
In other words, not Vogue. For Take Two, I'm Ari Saperstein.
All right, sticking with letters, 2 Southern California students are among the last 16 finalists in the Scripps National Spelling Bee. Now, as we speak, the competitors are taking a break, but they'll start spelling again at 5:30 tonight. You can actually watch it on ESPN if you like. 8th grader Aisha Randwa of Corona remains in today's finals after correctly spelling words like epicedium, which is another word for a funeral dirge.
Epicedium. E-P-I- C-E-D-I-U-M, epicedium.
Correct.
8th grader Nicholas DeSa of Tustin is also in the finals. He correctly spelled words like this one, meaning a ruler of the Eastern Roman Empire.
Basileus.
B-A-S-I-L-E-U-S. Basileus. Correct.
No speller from Orange County or Riverside County has ever won the spelling bee. So G-O-O-D-L-U-C-K to them. Good luck. That's as far as I can do. All right, you can always find us on Twitter. We're at Take Two. That's at Take Two. You can find me on Twitter as well at AMartinezLA. That's at AMartinezLA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.